content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the March 7th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. He's standing against kind of a greenish-yellow backdrop. In his right hand is a stack of red Make America Great Again hats. In his left hand, he's placing one of those hats on the head of a military leader who's standing at salute. He's the last one in a long line of military leaders from the various branches, all now with MAGA hats on and saluting. The headline is "A MAGA Military: Why Hegseth and Trump Are Purging the Pentagon." We get that story in the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the first main story. Trump abandons Ukraine at the UN. What happened? President Trump shredded the U.S. foreign policy playbook this week as his administration opposed a United Nations resolution condemning Russia as the aggressor in its war on Ukraine and strong-armed Ukraine into a deal that would give the U.S. a cut of its mineral wealth. Under a draft of the agreement seen by the New York Times, Ukraine would contribute half of the revenue from future government-owned mines, natural gas wells, and other natural resource projects into an investment fund jointly controlled with the U.S. missing from the draft. Was Trump's earlier demand that Ukraine pay $500 billion for past American military aid, as well as any commitment by the U.S. to safeguard Ukraine from future attacks, a provision Kyiv insists is necessary to secure the ceasefire that Trump is negotiating with Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is expected to travel to Washington to sign the deal after the week went to press, called the draft agreement a framework that can be part of future security guarantees. Trump, who recently accused Kyiv of starting the war, said he wouldn't make significant security promises to Ukraine, adding, "We're going to have Europe do that." At the UN General Assembly, the U.S. joined Russia, Belarus, and North Korea in voting against a European Union-Ukrainian resolution that condemned Russia's 2022 invasion, called for an immediate withdrawal of troops, and demanded accountability for Russian war crimes. The resolution passed 93-18, with 65 countries abstaining. The UN then considered a U.S.-authored resolution that lamented the tragic loss of life in Ukraine, but did not assign blame for the conflict. France amended the resolution to state that the conflict was the result of a full-scale Russian invasion. It passed 93-8, with 73 abstentions, including the U.S. During a visit to the White House, French President Emmanuel Macron warned Trump in a joint press conference against striking a ceasefire deal with Russia that is weak, or that involves the surrender of Ukraine. Trump falsely claimed that the U.S. had spent three times as much on the war as Europe had. Europe has spent an estimated $138 billion, about $20 billion more than the U.S., and said he believes Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to make a deal. He refused to refer to Putin as a dictator, despite labeling Zelensky one last week. "I don't use those words lightly," Trump said. What the editorial said: Trump has all but incinerated 80 years of post-war American leadership, said the Financial Times. Our allies in NATO and the EU are watching in horror as Washington drops any pretense of a commitment to defending democracy. Ukraine finds wavering support replaced by outright predation. This shift isn't just a whim or a clever chess move by Trump. His admiration for strongmen is real. and he's now making authoritarian countries that were once America's adversaries, like Putin's Russia, into its friends. Even a toothless UN resolution stating Russia's obvious guilt in Ukraine is now too much for America, said the Wall Street Journal. It suggests Trump wants a quick peace deal more than Putin does. If so, our president would be wise to revisit the cautionary tale of Joe Biden. His 2021 withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan was hasty, deadly, harmful to U.S. interests, and it caused his popularity to tank. What the columnist said, Kyiv may be breathing a small sigh of relief after Trump called the proposed mineral deal very big, said the economist. The Ukrainians survived a bare-knuckle fight with his administration, which initially made brazen, extractive demands that would have economically crippled the country for generations. A lot is still hazy about the deal, including how much control the U.S. will exercise over the new fund. But Ukraine has brought Trump back from the brink, and in this newly chaotic world, that counts for quite a lot. Any peace deal that requires sacrifice, said Noah Rothman in National Review. But must that include the U.S. becoming a complicit party to the Kremlin's lies? At the UN and in media interviews, Trump officials have refused to call Russia the aggressor. Such terms are not useful, said Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Apparently pressuring Ukraine to consent to its own dismemberment, administration officials want Kyiv to give up Crimea and other Russian-occupied territory, is not enough. We must also embrace the propaganda spouted by Moscow's most shameless sophists. Why are we kowtowing to Putin, asked Kathy Young in the Bulwark. Russia has suffered some 800,000 casualties in the three-year war, failed to dissolve Ukrainian front lines, and is not even close to completely retaking Ukrainian-occupied Kursk. Putin's best hope of winning this fight is getting the U.S. to coerce Ukraine into a sham of a peace deal, and Trump is happily complying. Not even Trump voters want that, said Henry Olson in the New York Post. A recent poll found 52% of his supporters favored cutting back on U.S. aid to Ukraine, but a supermajority considers Russia unfriendly or adversarial, and 55% say they'd prefer it retained no Ukrainian territory. These rank-and-file Republicans may never have expected America to become one of the bad guys, said Nick Cartagio in the Dispatch. But here we are. Eventually, it'll be hard to ignore the cascade of consequences. Chinese takeover of Taiwan, perhaps. This purportedly isolationist president is apt to encourage a lot of war by cozying up to Putin, and he's asking Americans to take sides with evil. Here's hoping he and his enablers fail spectacularly. Controversy of the week. Defense. Why is Trump purging the Pentagon? President Trump shredded America's soft power by gutting USAID, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Now he seems bent on damaging U.S. hard power, too. Hours after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced plans last week to cut 5,400 civilian Pentagon employees, Trump conducted his own Friday night massacre. He fired a half dozen top military leaders, including General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., the second African-American to serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Admiral Lisa Franchetti, chief of naval operations. Hegseth offered no rationale for the dismissals, except that they would somehow refocus the military on its core mission of deterring, fighting, and winning wars. But it's telling that Trump's chosen replacement for Brown is Lieutenant General Dan Raisin Kane, a white, retired, three-star Air Force officer. Kane's selection tells black and female officers that their prospects for promotion may be gravely limited, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. Worse is Trump's stated reason for the pick, that when he met Kane during a 2018 visit to troops in Iraq, Kane put on a MAGA hat and told him, "I think you're great, sir. I'll kill for you, sir." Trump's proud sharing of this story, denied by Kane and other officials, is a nerve-wracking clue to the president's plans for the military once he's cleansed its upper ranks of diversity and suspected disloyalty. General Brown is an honorable man, said Rich Lowry in National Review, but he had to go. The former F-16 pilot used his position as a political soapbox, releasing an emotional video after the 2020 killing of George Floyd about the challenges of being black in the Air Force. Brown's job is to be a killer, not to pontificate on hot-button political and social issues. Like many of the other fire generals, he is a bland product of an ossified system that rewards bureaucratic conformity over original thinking. That's doubly true of the military lawyers known as Judge Advocates General, or JAGs, said the Wall Street Journal. When Trump fired the three JAGs overseeing the Army, Navy, and Air Force last week, it set off a predictable media panic about imminent lawlessness. In truth, the JAGs had long favored risk elimination over mission success, leaving America's military far less lethal and effective than it needs to be in this dangerous world. Call me paranoid, said Charles P. Pierce, an Esquire. But yes, it does feel troublesome that Trump specifically fired the lawyers charged with resisting illegal presidential orders. Nor was it reassuring when Hegseth explained the JAGs had been fired to stop them from being roadblocks to anything that happens. We know what kind of anything Hegseth might have in mind, said Paul McCleary in Politico. The former Fox News host promotes a swaggering warrior ethos that rejects the Geneva Conventions. In Trump's first term, he successfully lobbied Trump to pardon two soldiers charged with war crimes and to reinstate Eddie Gallagher, a Navy SEAL accused of killing civilians and stabbing a teenage ISIS prisoner to death. Trump's purge has nothing to do with lethality or promoting warfighters or any other buzzwords, said Tim Nichols in The Atlantic. It's the next step in pursuit of total power. After capturing the intelligence services, the Justice Department, and the FBI, the Pentagon is the last piece he needs to establish the foundations for authoritarian control of the U.S. government. With his generals in charge, Trump can start building a military that is loyal to him and not to the Constitution. It is Praetorianism, plain and simple. Here's a good week, bad week piece. It's a good week for fantasy. After President Trump shared an AI-generated video on social media imagining post-war life in Trump Gaza, the remodeled Palestinian territory is depicted as a beachfront paradise where scantily clad revelers cavort beneath a golden Trump statue while a chiseled Elon Musk eats hummus and throws banknotes into the air. It was a good week for sharing. After a Frenchman whose stolen credit card was used to buy a winning lottery ticket offered to drop criminal charges against the thieves if they came forward and to give them half the unclaimed $523,000 jackpot. "You risk nothing," said the victim's lawyer. It was a good week for J.D. Vance. After New York Yankees owner Hal Steinbrenner cited the hirsute vice president as an inspiration for nixing the team's half-century ban on players with beards. The vast majority of 20s, 30s, into the 40s men in this country have beards, he said. It's part of their persona. But it was a bad week for forbidden love. After a student at China's Hefei University sparked a fire in his dormitory when he tried to burn his inflatable sex doll girlfriend to hide her from his roommate. No one was hurt in the blaze. The university advised students that items no longer needed can be disposed of in the trash can. It's a bad week for geometry. After Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, expressing enthusiasm for Defense Department budget cuts, told reporters that he'd support taking it from a Pentagon to a Trigon. Cut a couple sides off it. Experts say the accepted term for a three-sided shape is triangle. Finally, it was a bad week for waking up after European Union agriculture officials banned the use of coffee as a pesticide, ruling that caffeine is harmful to humans if swallowed. Consuming the toxic substance, officials noted, can affect the cardiovascular system and cause behavioral changes. And a short and other news piece. White House takes control of press pool that covers president. Breaking with more than a half century of tradition, President Trump announced this week that he will pick which reporters are allowed access into his daily activities as part of the presidential press pool. That job was previously handled by the Independent White House Correspondents Association, WHCA. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said the change would give new voices the chance to ask questions of the president. Right-wing outlets Blaze Media and Newsmax were this week assigned pool slots that would traditionally have gone to Reuters and the Associated Press. The AP has been barred from the Oval Office and Air Force One for using the name Gulf of Mexico to refer to the body of water that Trump decreed the Gulf of America. In a free country, said WHCA President Eugene Daniels, leaders must not be able to choose their own press corps. Time for the briefing. Title this week, Removing the Enemy Within. The last time the federal workforce was purged, it was in the name of fighting communism. When did the purge begin? The so-called Red Scare started in the early days of the Cold War. With America gripped by fears of communist infiltration, President Harry Truman in 1947 signed an executive order mandating a loyalty investigation of every person entering civilian employment. Over the following decade, more than 5 million federal workers filled out loyalty questionnaires, which led to 25,000 in-depth investigations, 2,700 firings, and 12,000 resignations, but not a single spy being unearthed. Workers could be placed under suspicion for past Communist Party membership, for supporting certain left-wing causes, or even for socializing across racial lines. Senator Joseph McCarthy, the Republican from Wisconsin, made the Red Scare into a public spectacle, grilling hundreds of Americans in Senate hearings about enemies from within. The communist agents supposedly burrowed inside the military and government agencies. But McCarthyism encompassed much more than the antics of one notorious senator, said historian Ellen Schrecker. It was the longest-lasting and most widespread episode of political repression in American history. Were Red Scare fears baseless? Not entirely, because the Soviets really were recruiting Americans. Physicist Klaus Fuchs and other scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project funneled nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union, information that helped the Kremlin build and detonate its first atomic bomb in 1949. And Julius Rosenberg, a civil engineer with the Army Signal Corps, was convicted of atomic spying in 1951 and executed along with his wife, Ethel. But while the loyalty program began as an understandable response to Soviet espionage, it soon expanded to a witch hunt that ensnared thousands of innocent Americans. Most of the State Department's China experts were fired after Mao Zedong's communist forces defeated the pro-Western nationalists and took control of China in 1949. The so-called China hands had warned for years such an outcome was likely, but following Mao's victory, their prediction was taken as evidence that they'd been soft on communism and had even helped Mao. How were subversives identified? Under Truman's executive order, the Civil Service Commission screened every current and new employee, examining government files, police records, and even college transcripts. If any hint of subversive activity was discovered, the FBI would then dig through the worker's private life. The loyalty program's first director, Seth Richardson, said officials could dismiss suspected subversives without any hearing whatsoever. James Kutcher, a Veterans Administration staffer who lost both his legs to a mortar shell in World War II, was fired for belonging to the tiny anti-Stalinist Socialist Workers' Party. For Bertha Lomax of the Government Printing Office, membership in the NAACP was enough to get her fired. President Dwight D. Eisenhower expanded the purge when he took office in 1953, ordering that federal employees be investigated for any criminal, infamous, dishonest, immoral, or notoriously disgraceful conduct, habitual use of intoxicants to excess, drug addiction, sexual perversion, all classed as threats to national security. Thousands of gay and lesbian federal workers and service members lost their job as a result. What role did Congress play? Suspects and witnesses were subpoenaed by the House Un-American Activities Committee and McCarthy in the Senate. The fame-hungry senator launched his red hunt in 1950 with a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, where he brandished a list of 205 supposed communists working and shaping policy in the State Department. McCarthy never publicly released the list, but he held more than a dozen hearings on subversion. He claimed the State Department's Voice of America radio service was full of communist sympathizers. None were found, but one VOA engineer killed himself, and that the U.S. Information Service was circulating red books by writers such as Langston Hughes and Dashiell Hammett. McCarthy labeled witnesses who chose not to surrender his questions during hearings, to answer his questions during hearings, like the Maltese Falcon author Hammett, Fifth Amendment communist. Why did the purges stop? Partly because of McCarthy's hubris. In 1954, a few years after accusing then-Secretary of Defense George C. Marshall of invariably serving the world policy of the Kremlin, McCarthy declared communists had infiltrated the Army. The televised Army-McCarthy hearings showed the senator bullying witnesses and presenting doctored evidence. Journalists became more candid in their criticism, and the Senate voted that December to censure McCarthy. He sank into alcoholism and died in 1957, 1 year after the Supreme Court put limits on loyalty investigations. Did the purge change government? It likely robbed Washington of valuable expertise. Doctors, scientists, and military officers were among those purged. Writer and historian Clay Risen notes that the Asia experts fired by the State Department might well have raised the right objections to America's short-sighted anti-communism in East Asia, above all its rush to intervene in Vietnam. The legacy of the purge was also felt in the way politicians and bureaucrats curbed their speech to avoid being labeled Reds. Talk of universal health care disappeared from mainstream debates, for example, despite having been championed by Truman. A government loyalty program amounts to thought control, O. John Rogg, former U.S. Assistant Attorney General, said in 1948. It deprives workers of the freedom to participate without fear in political activity, he said. More than that, it deprives our country of the type of intelligent civil servant that we do urgently require. Read a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. What Musk's black hat really signifies. Elon Musk's black MAGA hat isn't just a black hat, said Jonathan B. Last. It's a brand in competition with Trump. The tech billionaire first donned the black cap with MAGA lettering at an October rally for then-candidate Donald Trump, but has since spotted it at an array of events alongside Trump. The black hat is a provocation. Musk's attempt to brand dark MAGA as a splinter movement from Trump's original red cap populism. Unlike conventional MAGA's fixation on immigration, culture war, conservation, and conservatism, and reviving manufacturing jobs, dark MAGA aims to impose a big tech oligarchy on the U.S., with a ruthless authoritarian government that eliminates regulation of tech companies, self-driving cars, and AI, and promotes the interest of Musk and the wealthy. With the black hat, Musk is saying that he's not a mere foot soldier in Trump's army, but the commander of his own forces and a possible rival for control of the larger MAGA movement. In joint appearances, Trump is curiously submissive around Musk, who has far more wealth, intelligence, and business success. Remember, Musk did not found Tesla, but joined the company as an investor and advisor. Before long, he pushed the founders out and took over. The folly of eliminating taxes on tips. Eliminating taxes on tips is a really bad idea, said Adam Chojuro. When Donald Trump suggested eliminating federal taxes on tips last year, it seemed like a hollow campaign promise aimed at wooing voters in Las Vegas service industry. But Republicans are now reportedly considering including tax-free tips in their big budget reconciliation bill. Unfortunately, the policy will do little for and possibly really hurt many of those it ostensibly is designed to help. If tips are not taxed, service industry workers may save some money in the short run, but it will lower their eventual Social Security benefits, which are based on taxed income. If customers know that waitstaff, baristas, and bartenders don't pay taxes on tips, they may start tipping less. This tax exemption would also undermine efforts to raise the minimum wage, which is even lower for tipped workers. The policy would be fiscally irresponsible, costing the deficit-plagued federal government an estimated $100 billion over 10 years. Finally, exempting tips would be unfair to jobs with similar pay scales that aren't tipped. Do we really want to create a tax incentive for folks to become bartenders instead of teachers? This column comes from China. Why Europe should partner with us. The European Union is surely feeling betrayed by the America First Donald Trump administration, said China Daily. Trump has turned his back on America's oldest allies, slamming them with tariffs, criticizing their democracies, and even threatening to withdraw U.S. military protection. But a crisis like this can also be an opportunity. For Europe, the best way to respond to Trump's cold shoulder is to turn to friendly, welcoming China. Foreign Minister Wang Yi has been urging counterparts in Ireland, France, Germany, the Czech Republic, and the European Commission to extend their mutually beneficial cooperation with China, making it bigger, stronger, deeper, and more concrete. This isn't just an impromptu and opportunistic grab for the business opportunities America is recklessly leaving behind. China has long been planning an outreach to coincide with this year's 50th anniversary of EU-China relations. The trade volume between China and the EU already reached $786 billion in 2024, and in future we could link up our Belt and Road Initiative with the EU's Global Gateway to promote high-quality development. Let Trump go it alone. Brussels and Beijing can work together to realize the bright prospects of peace, security, prosperity, and progress. The last word, feature article, stretching out. Yes, surgery can make you 3 inches taller, said Brittany Megia in the Los Angeles Times. Just be prepared for $100,000 in bills and a long, painful recovery. Las Vegas. Late at night on long drives around his Indiana hometown, Eli Mattern would ask God why he made the teenager the way he was. The high schooler's 5'7" stature, 2 inches below the average man in America, consumed his thought. An ex-girlfriend told Mattern she was glad they were breaking up because he was short. He wore shoes to make himself taller at the prom last year. He grew so depressed over his height he became suicidal. He lives among tall people in a state that embraces its towering basketball players. For example, Larry Bird, clocking in at 6'9", and that was once home to the world's tallest woman, Sandy Allen, 7'7¼". I just started getting really insecure and comparing myself with people around me, recalled Mattern, a high school senior. It really started getting into my head. And that's how the 18-year-old ended up on a Las Vegas operating table in December. A chisel-like surgical tool called an osteotome wedged into his femur. As Dr. Kevin Depiparshad whacked it with a mallet. This is the art of getting taller. Cost? Around $100,000. Surgery, pain, months of recovery. What might seem crazy to some, cosmetic leg lengthening, is a growing business for Depiparshad. Dr. D to patients and staff, who does more than 100 of these surgeries a year, and has become the face of the procedure. Featured in a Hulu documentary, Short Kings, The Business of Getting Tall, his patients have included tech bros, finance guys, social media influencers, athletes, actors, and a well-known musician. Also among the ranks, Adam Eza, a crypto guy turned federal inmate in Los Angeles, who reportedly spent more than $60,000 for Depiparshad to extend the length of his legs. A November hearing revolved around Eza wanting the rods implanted in his femurs removed, a procedure he'd put off, his lawyer said, because the recovery had been painful. They were finally taken out the week of Mattern surgery. A U.S. Marshal was in the operating room with Eisen. Male height has long been a fixation in society, worming its way into our vernacular. Short Kings, Napoleon Complex, into our music. Skilo's line, I wish I was a little bit taller. And Randy Newman's, I don't want no short people. Into TikTok videos, I'm looking for a man in finance with a trust fund, 6'5", blue eyes. Depiparshad, 43, says his patients turn to him for reasons similar to why people might do other cosmetic procedures. Very like rhinoplasty or breast augmentation or Botox, he said. I think it's just to feel more comfortable in your skin. Dawn Mattern wiped away tears. Her son ran to find her tissues. They had flown to Las Vegas from Indiana the day before. They were waiting in a patient room at the Limplast X Institute to meet Depiparshad for the first time in person, ahead of what Dawn called Mattern's life-changing surgery. Donna and her husband had adopted Madden as a baby. He had grown into a soft-spoken teenager with an easy smile and a love of weightlifting, reflected in his muscular build. To his parents, he was perfect. Mother and son were nearly matched in height, the right size, Dawn said, for hugs. But over the last year, she had seen a shift in her son. Madden became quiet, withdrawn. Eventually, he confided that he'd grown depressed over his height. It wasn't about what anyone else thought, he told her. It was how he felt about himself. Diminished. As he searched for a solution, Madden learned about leg lengthening surgery. When he came to us about getting this done, I'm thinking, well, I'll do whatever it takes to make him not be so down and depressed, Dawn said. You just do what you got to do as a parent for your child. Dawn did her own research and contacted the Limplast X Institute last year. She said they wanted Madden to get the surgery during his Christmas break. She had suggested he try therapy ahead of surgery. Instead, after his Monday shifts as a veterinary assistant, Madden went across the street to his family non-denominational Christian church and spoke with the pastor. Are you going to be happy after this? Is this really going to fix it all for you? Or are you going to find something else after this that you don't like about yourself and get down about that? He recalled the pastor asking. I think it'll help a lot, Madden told him. There's really nothing else I'm insecure about myself. It's always just been my height. I guess that's why I've always believed this would fix that, because I've only ever not liked my height. The Sunday before Madden flew to Las Vegas, more than 60 congregants encircled him at church. They laid their hands on the tormented young man. They prayed his surgery would go well. Madden would be gone for a month, initially staying at a condo a short walk from where he'd complete physical therapy. His mother would be with him every step of the way. I could not be doing this without you here, Madden told his mom as they waited in the patient room on that December morning. Debbie Parshad, who is 5'10", walked into the room with a flurry of information. The surgery would last about an hour and a half. The doctor would then try to get Madden up and moving within 4 hours. Debbie Parshad handed Madden a nail like the one that would go into his leg the next day. The Precise 2.2, an FDA-cleared implantable lengthening device made of titanium. He'd removed it from a patient who had already attained his desired height. After surgery, Madden would use a small device to expand the nail, which has a magnet inside, 1 millimeter a day for about 2.5 months, allowing for new bone to grow over the break. Within a year, the nail would be removed, as recommended by the FDA. Madden's new bone, Debbie Parshad explained, would be as structurally sound as your normal bone, but it would be synthesized out of thin air. Madden had one question for the surgeon. After he'd gained around 3.2 inches, would he be able to weightlift as he does now? Debbie Parshad explained there could be a mild decrease in athleticism, somewhere in the 10% range. Still, he said he had operated on a marathon runner 8 years ago. The man is in his 50s and can run a 7.5-minute mile. Weightlifters such as Madden, Debbie Parshad assured him, returned pretty close to normal after surgery. Debbie Parshad said he'd operated on many other high schoolers. Some had gone back to school on crutches or in a wheelchair. The doctor asked Madden if he'd thought about how he would explain his height increase to his classmates. Everybody around me already knows, Madden says. And how was their perception of that? Debbie Parshad asked. My friends are very supportive, he said. Everyone else thinks I'm an idiot. Madden lay unconscious on a stainless steel table in operating room B5 at Sunrise Hospital and Medical Center. His upper body was shrouded in a blue surgical drape, his lower body strategically taped for privacy. His tree trunk-like thighs, the stars of the show, were bare, tinged yellow from iodine solution used to prep the skin for surgery. The rhythmic beeping of the machine monitoring Madden's heart filled the room. His right thigh was illuminated by a spotlight. His surgical team of 7 took their positions, actors in a play they'd performed 100 times. Incision now, Debbie Parshad said, as he made the first of six small cuts between hip and knee on the outside of Mattern's right thigh. These would be the only incisions he would make that day on Mattern's right leg. Debbie Parshad, perched on a stool, wedged scissors into the first incision. He cut Mattern's iliotibial band to prevent the tough tissue, which runs the length of the femur, from impeding the leg lengthening process. The snap of the tissue being cut sounded like the crunch of walking on fresh snow, the surgeon said. Blood trickled down Mattern's leg. Debbie Parshad sopped it up with gauze. Next, he held a ruler in one gloved hand and a pen in the other, positioning them over a meaty thigh to measure the exact place where he would break Mattern's femur. The scrub technician passed Debbie Parshad a 5-millimeter drill. The doctor sent it whirring into Mattern's bone. He was creating a line of perforations circling the femur to make it easier to break the strongest bone in the body, akin to the small bones that help tear a paper towel. When the doctor removed the drill to cool it down with the tech's waiting cup of water, steam-like wisps of smoke radiated off. "Are we ready?" Debbie Parshad asked, before starting to whack the osteotome with a mallet, the way one would hammer a nail into a wall. He repeatedly called for an x-ray to ensure the osteotome was positioned correctly in the bone and complete the break. "Wow, really good Indiana bone," Debbie Parshad observed with a chuckle. Mattern, he later said, had been drinking his milk. Soon Debbie Parshad had hit the femur more than 60 times. After pulling out the osteotome, the doctor moved Mattern's whole leg to the right until there was a loud snap, like a wishbone breaking. Debbie Parshad inserted the nail through the small window he'd created at the top of the femur and secured the nail inside the bone with four screws. The surgery on Mattern's right leg took less than an hour. Next up, the left. The OR smelled like a dental office exam room when teeth are being drilled. A member of the surgical team called Dawn. Everything, they said, had gone perfectly. 2 days before Christmas, Mattern, still wearing his yellow hospital fall wrist bracelet, was wheeled to his first physical therapy session in the same building as Debbie Parshad's office. Three other patients were doing hamstring, quad, and other stretches. They hailed from different backgrounds and states, but were united in their desire to be taller. "Welcome, man. First 2 weeks is bad," a man called out to Mattern from where he lay stretching. "After 2 weeks, it's a lot better." That patient, a social media influencer with hundreds of thousands of followers, had gotten the surgery more than 2 months earlier. He agreed to be interviewed as long as his name was not included. He'd been embarrassed by the fact that his friends, male and female, were taller than him. He'd lost a few gigs because of his height, 5'4" 3/4", although he wouldn't go into detail. He referenced the 6'5" blue eyes TikTok video. "For taller people, you'll have a better chance of being more successful," he said. "If you're taller, people automatically have more respect for you." His friends, many of them doctors and surgeons, had told him not to get the procedure, saying there was not enough documentation of what would happen as he aged. But he figures that if I'm 60 or 70 years old, I'm not going to be running around anyways. There have been some challenges, he said, like the tightness in his legs that comes from not stretching enough. The first day out of the hospital, he'd had to yell for help after a food delivery driver left his order on the ground. He could not bend to reach it. But he's excited at the idea that he will be around 5'8" by the time this is over. Mattern faced his first challenge, getting out of the wheelchair and up onto a walker. Kim Bozart Dow, the physical therapy director, had him scoot to the edge of the chair and placed a hand over his lower back to help him propel him forward. "One step at a time," Bozart Dow told him, grasping his hips as he took each tentative step. "Left foot, right foot." Once he reached the treatment table, Mattern used his arms to guide himself onto it. Not long after Mattern's surgery, the teen and his mom were settled in a Las Vegas hotel. They had spent Christmas and New Year's away from Mattern's father and were ready to head home. Madden planned to attend school remotely after winter break finished. Just a couple days, Madden said proudly of his progress. I'll be half an inch on the way to his ultimate goal, 5'10". Version of this story was first published in the Los Angeles Times. Read one of the obituaries this week. The piano prodigy who sang Killing Me Softly. Roberta Flack, 1937 to 2025. Roberta Flack had no flash or gimmick to propel her to stardom. A school teacher in her 30s, when she achieved fame, she was a classically trained pianist with a low-key demeanor and a restrained vocal style. But she had a knack for getting deep inside a song and finding its heart. Her voice touched, tapped, trapped, and kicked every emotion I've ever known, said jazz musician Les McCann, who helped Flack get a record deal after seeing her perform in a nightclub. Flack notched some of the 1970s top hits, including The First Time I Ever I Saw Your Face, 1972, and Killing Me Softly with his song, 1973. Partnership with Donny Hathaway yielded others, such as the breezy Where Is the Love, 1972. While known as a soul R&B singer, Flack incorporated influences including jazz, pop, folk, and classical. I didn't try to be a soul singer, a jazz singer, a blues singer, no category, she said in 2020. My music is my expression of what I feel and believe in a moment. Roberta Cleopatra Flack was born in Black Mountain, North Carolina, where her father was a draftsman and her mother a church organist, said the Los Angeles Times. She began playing by ear at four and before long was studying the work of Bach and Chopin and performing in church. At 15, she won a scholarship to Howard University and later settled in Washington, D.C., where she taught music in schools by day and played clubs at night. She earned a devoted following, and after McCann lined her up with an audition at Atlantic Records, she recorded her debut album, First Take, 1969, in a day. Sales were modest, said the Associated Press, until director Clint Eastwood used First Time I Saw Your Face over a key scene in his steamy thriller, Play Misty for Me. The hushed, hymn-like ballad shot to number one, and Flack became an overnight star. Flack continued to log chart hits through the 70s, said Variety, but fell out of favor as taste moved to the harder sounds of funk, rap, and hip-hop. Yet she toured and recorded into the new millennium, having honed an unvarnished style that valued emotional expression over vocal razzle-dazzle. My main interest is in telling my story through a song, she said in 2020. Tell the truth with clarity and honesty so that the listener can feel their story. Here's one of the health and science articles. Headphones hurt kids' hearing. Noise-canceling headphones may be damaging young people's hearing. The technology, which effectively lowers the volume of distracting noises in loud places, is a common feature in modern earphones. But there is mounting evidence that excessive use robs the brain of practice processing background noise. This could cause auditory processing disorder, APD, which leaves people unable to understand spoken words and other sounds. Several hospital departments in the UK say they have seen rising numbers of young people coming in with hearing problems. One factor may be the desire to work in silence. Research by SonarWorks, an audio technology company, found that almost 50% of millennials don't listen to anything when wearing headphones at work, along with more than 25% of Gen Z. Our brain is remarkably adaptable, The more we engage it, the better it functions, especially when it comes to processing sounds and noise. Claire Benton, president of the British Academy of Audiology, tells the Times, "Think of it as use it or lose it. Dance for your exercise." When health experts say people should do about 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous exercise a week, they're usually talking about going to the gym, playing sports, or running. But a new study suggests there may be an easier way to get in those active minutes. Just dance around at home for 20 minutes. Researchers at Northeastern University asked 48 people ages 18 to 83 to dance for 5 minutes any way they wanted. Hip-hop moves, cha-cha-cha, whatever, and measured their heart rate and oxygen uptake as they did it. The idea, says lead author Aston McCullough, was to see whether they would reach a health-enhancing level of activity without being given any further instructions. The answer was yes, he says. They just put on their own music and danced around. And even when they didn't have music on, they were still reaching that level. The findings suggest that four a day of those five-minute bursts of so-called solo freeform dancing could be enough to meet recommended exercise guidelines, with the added bonus of being free and fun. On the Talking Points page, National Parks, feeling the pain of staff cuts. Chaos is spreading across our national parks, said Maxine Joslow and Andrea Sachs in the Washington Post. The Trump administration fired about 1,000 National Park Service employees in February, and the agency's 433 national parks, historic sites, and attractions are already feeling the pain. The sole locksmith at California's Yosemite National Park lost his job, leaving the park, about the size of Rhode Island, without anyone to rescue visitors trapped in locked bathrooms. The park postponed summer campground bookings, and employees protested the cuts last week by unfurling an upside-down American flag on the famous El Capitan rock face as a symbol of their distress. Wait times for motorists entering at Grand Canyon National Park in Arizona doubled to nearly 2 hours after the firing of four employees at the south entrance, where 90% of the park's almost 5 million annual visitors arrive. This purge is upending the lives of workers and disrupting visitors' experiences, and problems will only mount as the busy summer season approaches. This could turn an already existing staffing shortage into a full-blown crisis, said Benji Jones in Vox. Visitors to national parks soared past 325 million in 2023, 16% higher than in 2010, while staffing decreased by about 13%. The fired workers were largely probationary staff, but that's misleading, said Merrick Warzitsky in the Fresno Bee. Employees enter a 12-month probationary period when they change positions, so many were experienced workers. Ernest Wingate spent 15 seasons as an archaeologist at California's Sequoia National Forest and was just fired with 12 days left in his probation. "I took a lot of pride in my job and felt invested in the land," Wingate said. "Getting fired," he said, "is like a slap in the face." The national parks are often called America's best idea, said Mark Woods in the Florida Times Union. But slashing their workforce is a terrible idea. Operating hours, programs, and maintenance all could suffer. Amid these mindless cuts, there's something President Trump wants fast-tracked and fully funded. A sculpture garden called the National Garden of American Heroes. "We're firing dedicated park workers, ruining vacations, and threatening public land. But we'll spend millions to do this?" That's what comes off a president who values hotel towers, golf courses, and statues, but not Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, or Gettysburg. And a few of the shorter notes. The top 10% of earners in the U.S., households making $250,000 or more a year, now account for a record 50% of all spending. 3 decades ago, they accounted for about 36%. Flu-related deaths have topped deaths from COVID-19 this winter for the first time since the COVID pandemic began 5 years ago. This flu season is the worst in more than a decade, with at least 29 million infections, 370,000 hospitalizations, and 16,000 deaths. About 28% of federal workers are veterans, compared with 5% in the private sector, making it likely government staffing cuts will hit the community hard. Just over a third of veterans working in civil service, more than 200,000 people, are disabled or have a serious health condition. Doge head Elon Musk posted 1,314 times on the X platform that he owns last week, averaging about 187 posts a day. And we finish with a couple of quotes. First, we have Benjamin Franklin, who says, "We must hang together, or most assuredly, we will hang separately." And from Talleyrand, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, who has an interesting quote. He says, "Never speak ill of yourself. Your friends will say enough on that subject." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.